Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
So the demand for an investigation into the Democrats was part of the reason that he ordered to withhold funding to Ukraine.
The look back to what happened in 2016
investigation of Democrats
was part of the thing that he was worried about in corruption with that nation.
And withholding, the funding.
Yeah, okay. which ultimately then flowed.
I think that vote, the size of the vote, more than 2-1 of the Republicans voted to oppose what the president did, probably got to the president because he was shaken up by it.
He has called the press the enemy of the American people. And I will tell you, I've fought a lot of America's enemies. The press is not the enemy of the American people.
Hello and welcome to TrumpCast. I'm Virginia Heffernan. Parts of speech are meaningful. We talk a fair amount about pronouns in the culture lately, and rightly, but I want to say a word today about prepositions. On this day, when Representative Elijah Cummings of Baltimore, a masterful rhetorician in addition to a man of surpassing dignity and grace, has died. As Cummings said to Michael Cohen, as Cohen was bound for prison, when bad things happen to you, don't ask the question, why did it happen to me? Ask the question, why did it happen for me? I don't know, he said, why this is happening for you. He might have been speaking to the whole country. Why is Trump happening to us? Now, I may be showing my religious cards, but I second Cummings's choice of prepositions. Why is this happening for us? That's what we've had to think about for 3 years, and that's what we will continue to parse for decades to come. As listeners may know, one of the moments of testimony I've found most powerful during this catastrophic period in American history, and we've heard a lot of testimony, was Cohen's second hearing before the House Oversight Committee, which is chaired, was chaired, by Congressman Cummings. As an authentic statesman, Cummings really presides over proceedings, and Republicans and Democrats alike seemed to aim to curry favor with him while fearing his impatience and formidable side eye. Chief among the terrified that day was Representative Mark Meadows, the loud Republican from North Carolina, kind of Trump attack dog. When Cohen said in his opening statement that Trump is a racist, a cheat, and a con man, Meadows leapt in to present one of Trump's employees, a silent and young black woman, as token certification somehow of Trump's lack of racism, of his magnificent commitment to social justice. Rashida Tlaib rightly spotted this tokenism, especially trotting out of a black woman by a white man, as a racist set piece. But rather than let that factual observation stand, we all had to turn to Mark Meadows, who was affronted by this point and suddenly near tears. And that's where Cummings came in. Meadows appealed to Cummings as a friend to say, sob, that he wasn't a racist. And we know by now that white men have been hysterically seeking to discharge their pain in being caught on their victims. And Cummings was in what seemed like a tight spot. But then he did something that I now try to reproduce with my children. He didn't deny Meadows. He didn't starve him of that fellowship that Meadows so needed. But Cummings made it clear that his job is not to clear the consciences of others. It is not his job. That's Meadows' work. That will be the work of all the Trump enablers, from Bill Barr to Cohen to Gordon Sondland to Anthony Scaramucci to Ivanka Trump. Because, as Cummings said in his closing statements to Cohen, when we're dancing with the angels, the question will be asked in 2019, what did we do to make sure we kept our democracy intact? Did we stand on the sidelines and say nothing? Did we play games? And now that Cummings himself is dancing with the angels, we can all be grateful that the son of a sharecropper, as Trump pummeled him on Twitter, never stood on the sidelines. He never played games. He fought like hell to keep our democracy intact. And now we will continue that fight for him. Rest in peace and power, Elijah Eugene Cummings. My guest today to talk about national security, foreign policy, and Trump world corruption is the great Kate Brannon. She's the editorial director of Just Security and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council. Kate, welcome to TrumpCast.
Thanks so much for having me.
I love having you in studio. I can see you face to face.
Yes, we meet.
I can experience your wit in person, not just on Twitter. So I want to talk about Gordon Sondland and his fall, which is the way we first experienced him, and then his redemption. But to get into this topic, I think, call me.
Yes.
As Gordon Sondland would say, right?
Yes.
When things get sketchy, he tries to jump off the internet. Let's not text. Exactly. Exactly. At Goldman Sachs, did you know they used to, when they were talking about junk mortgages, would say, let's discuss live LDL.
No, I didn't.
These mortgages seem really trashy. And then the other guy would write back, LDL. And then they'd run to an alley. All right. So Gordon Sondland, who said, call me, who seemed very much like he was piping in Trump's agenda to obscure the fact that this was quid pro quo, or at least a bid for interference in an American election that Trump made to President Zelensky. We're back talking about Zelensky, by the way, not Erdogan, not yet. But now Sondland has his statement, which redeems him a little bit, his statement to Congress. What'd you think of it?
Right. So he is up on the Hill as we speak, testifying in the basement in a skiff to House investigators. And on the call me point, I thought it was funny. He says, you know, when I said, let's not text, call me, it's not because I was trying to hide anything or not leave a written record. I just meant diplomacy is better conducted in person. It's too complicated to do over text. And so we should really get on the call.
These emojis are just not capturing the nuance.
No. But he also talks about, so Taylor texted him and said, I really don't like this quid pro quo path we're going down, basically.
Yes.
And I'm paraphrasing him, which I know now is a criminal treasonous offense, so I apologize.
It's an Adam Schiff style. Yes. I think what he said was something like, are we saying that support is conditioned on Zelensky reopening this investigation into the Bidens?
Exactly.
Something like that. That's not a parody.
Right. And so that's when Sondland said, let's not text. Again, I'm paraphrasing. And then 5 hours pass, and we know because it had been reported that Sondland had picked up the phone and talked to Trump in the intervening time and then texted back, there's no quid pro quo. And so in his opening statement, he talks about this phone call he had with Trump. He says Trump repeatedly said, no quid pro quo, no quid pro quo, and that Trump was in a bad mood when he had that phone call.
We don't know what happened. We're just taking this on Sondland's. It doesn't sound like Trump. The bad mood and the chronic self-repetition. It's unusual for him. He never gets stuck on a phrase. No quid pro quo, no quid pro quo, no collusion, all that.
Yeah.
So, okay, he says no quid pro quo, which is the new phrase for collusion, the thing that Trump needs to get away from himself.
Right.
Okay, and then Sondland says?
Well, to zoom out, so that's just that one exchange that Sondland addresses in his opening statement. More broadly, Sondland confirms that at Trump's direction, which is really important, it was clear to Sondland that Trump wanted to delegate Ukraine policy to Rudy Giuliani and that all sort of Ukraine policy should go through him. And this disappointed and was not the preferred route for people like Sondland, Volker, who was the special envoy to Ukraine, and Bill Taylor, who had become the ambassador to Ukraine after Yovanovitch was kicked out. And so he sort of confirms that, yes, and publicly, that yes, all the Ukraine policy then had to go through Trump's personal lawyer, which was super bizarre, and that this happened because Trump wanted it to, and that it was Sondland's impression that Rudy was merely conveying Trump's preferences and wishes. And so connecting that dot to Trump, I think, is important, even though to us it's obvious that if Giuliani's involved, it's because Trump wants him to. Otherwise, why on earth would Giuliani be playing a role in any of this?
Yep.
But for Sondland to say that out loud, I think, is really important, just to connect the dots back to the president.
Absolutely. I mean, doesn't this remind you of the ways that Michael Cohen a little bit tried to connect the dots, that he remembered Don Jr. consulting with his father upstairs in Trump Tower about the meeting that he had just proudly organized to get dirt on Hillary Clinton from a Russian lawyer, from Natalia Veselnitskaya. There's something, it's like the Mueller report is, or some of the details of that are repeating themselves here.
Yes.
It's like he's like a serial killer with a clear M.O.
Yes.
You
know, another key part of that that comes from Cohen is Trump talks in code. And, you know when he's saying a certain thing that it means this other thing. And so that's so obvious with this story with the corruption. Go after corruption in Ukraine. What is corruption? Apparently, the number one issue of corruption in Ukraine is Hunter Biden's job at the oil company versus the far larger issues that if you were truly tackling corruption in Ukraine, that you would actually be interested in.
Right. The American nepotism is not really their worry. And Hunter Biden did virtually nothing on the board seat. He had bigger fish to fry with his own personal problems.
Correct.
Anyway, so yes. And Zelensky, does he even use in that call? And I know we're going back a bit, but does he even use in the call Biden's name? I can't remember.
Trump does.
Okay,
and so
yes.
Another key part of this Sondland statement, a few things. He says he was not on the July 25th call between Trump and Zelensky, and that the versions of the call he saw didn't mention Biden, didn't even mention that Trump made a request of Zelensky. And so it sounds like he saw some version of this call that was scrubbed. He also says versions of the call, which make you think, well, how many sort of loose transcripts of this call were put out there by the White House?
And also, if there's a still more scrubbed version, why did Trump release to the public one that we know is partial, but it's plenty damning?
Right. And Sondland says he didn't see that transcript until we saw it when the White House released it. And so he didn't know the extent to which Trump had asked quite specifically of Zelensky to investigate the Bidens. But what Sondland leaves out of his opening statement is the Washington Post reported in a story earlier this week about the big role that Mick Mulvaney has played in all of this.
Yes.
That as they prepared for this July 25th phone call between Zelensky and Trump, Bolton wanted to prepare the president. Bolton could sort of see that this was like off the rails. He saw that Giuliani was playing this bizarre role in all of this and was really sort of worried about it. And so Bolton wanted to be the one to prep the president. But Mulvaney made sure that Sondland was able to prep the president as well because they were sort of running this parallel side Ukraine policy track.
Yeah.
And so Mulvaney put Sondland through to the president, and Sondland, on the day after the call, told a Ukrainian television station, I actually spoke to the president minutes before he got on the phone with President Zelensky. Mm-hmm. Now, in Sondland's opening statement, he goes through all of what he believes are the relevant sort of moments in this whole story, and he leaves that out, which is obviously, right. I think that the House investigators today will probably ask him about that and what was said, but it was not in his opening statement.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
One of the things, and I think Matt Miller dug this up, a huge use of Twitter to me is that there's so many archivists on it that remember exactly where something appeared, and they remember so quickly. Anyway, Matt Miller found in one of the early reports on Russian interference, and this is like from, I think from early 2017, not the Mueller report, but some other kind of write-up, I'm not sure what, but he found an example of Zhirinovsky, the far-right Russian politician, saying, cheering Trump's victory and saying, now we get something like, now we get Ukraine and Syria, right?
Yikes.
Yeah. You know, it's like the way that Trump used to say erroneously that Muslims were cheering 9/11, American Muslims, that, you know, really the very far right that has this very clear agenda around, very far right in Russia, very clear agenda in getting back Ukraine, which it thinks it's owed or it's rightfully belongs to the Russian Federation, and then also getting its way in Syria. And this is payback time for Trump. I mean, as Pelosi said yesterday, all roads lead to the Kremlin with Trump.
Right.
It's astonishing. National security is your beat. I mean, how has this been for you and your team at Just Security? Is it shocking? I mean, really, this is like unshockable people. See, like, we're losing the Pax Americana. But worse, our president is a bad actor. He's a rogue state in himself.
Yeah. Well, at Just Security, I'm sort of one of the few journalists among a lot of lawyers and a lot of former government lawyers. And I am often shocked, but also not surprised. There's that weird feeling in the Trump era where you're like, I know this is going to get so bad.
Yes.
And so when it does, you're like, oh, yep, that's what I expected.
Yes.
And at the same time, you're shocked by the details of it. But I find I'm often less shocked sometimes than people who, you know, worked in the Obama administration, have worked in, you know, other administrations, Bush, Obama, et cetera, a lot of, you know, career civil servants, foreign servants, defense officials are truly shocked.
Yeah.
Because this isn't the way things are supposed to go. These aren't the people who are supposed to have these jobs.
Yeah.
And I think it really does, you know, it rattles all of us, but it really rattles people who have been on the inside and I think have a better sense of how much is at stake than us. On the outside.
One of the ways that anyone who's been in a career, especially career diplomats, are probably their jaws have dropped, including, we know for a fact, Maria Yovanovitch was just appalled and devastated by what she saw happening. So yesterday we saw the letter of Donald Trump to Recep Erdogan of Turkey that is, on the one hand, beyond parody. It was so, seemed so satirical that even the, you know, the New York Times had to kind of triple check that this was really what the president of the United States had written to, you know, Erdogan, the brutal head of an autocrat, head of a theocracy. Every Turk I know is travel banned from returning to Turkey. And then Trump had this exchange with him that I don't even know what to liken it to. I don't know. What did you think when you saw that letter?
Well, a few things about it. First, we know, I think it was dated from last week.
Yes, that's right.
And so we know it was ignored.
Yes, because he asked for Erdogan to not be responsible for the slaughter of thousands or something by taking advantage of Trump's withdrawal of troops, right, from the border and actually rushing into Syria.
Right.
Which, yeah.
It's not clear. I mean, both Trump and, or not Trump, but his administration and Republicans on the Hill are trying to draw a line that Erdogan can't cross when clearly Erdogan has already crossed the line. But I've seen discussion like if they enter Kobani, that's it. And they're kind of trying to create a line in the future when the line has already been crossed. But back to the letter, I thought what was so interesting was the White House released this letter to Trish Regan at Fox News showing that this is something they're proud of. Like, this is what your president did, you know, did on this topic.
Right.
He sent this letter.
It's a deal maker.
And I thought yesterday the letter combined, Trump released this photo from his meeting with the Democrats in the White House where Nancy Pelosi, the speaker, was standing up pointing her finger at him.
Yes.
And he looks kind of flushed and angry. And she, while standing up and stern, doesn't look out of control. And the White House thought both the letter and that photo worked to their advantage.
This is a brilliant point. Yes.
And it shows how Trump has just an utter lack of self-awareness.
Yes.
That both of those things are so completely damning.
Yes. Yes.
And together, they just added to this feeling yesterday.
He has this, you know, internal worldview that distorts reality. And every now and then, he tries to supply receipts to show that he's right. And then when you see through his eyes, when you see, like, Pelosi, she looks, as you said, dignified and stern and exactly the way we would have her in a meeting, which has a general, you know, all white men. I think there's you know, one of the aides is a woman, or maybe one or two of the aides. But she's there in blue, all these men around the table, all Trump side men around the table, except Schumer. And there she is, you know, making this clear point, and he decides to call it a meltdown.
It's, I mean, the photo as a woman, as a critic of Trump,
yeah.
I mean, the photo is fantastic.
No, we that would be a, like, great screensaver to keep our...
Well, and Nancy Pelosi made it her backdrop on her Twitter profile.
Good. Yeah.
So it shows sort of how that went down.
You know what is funny about that? I don't know if you saw that this morning, but Bill Kristol put, maybe I am a feminist after all, at the top of it. And then, this is just another sign of our times, and then George Conway retweeted that and said, maybe I'm a feminist also.
Yeah.
That's what it took. That's what it took for these two very right-wing men to decide, you know, forget Gloria Steinem, forget Me Too, forget. They, like, finally saw what that looks like to be alone in a room. And now, I mean, Pelosi, I do not know how mother of five and a grandmother is at this crux of history, and now without Elijah Cummings at her side.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned her as a mother, because as a mother myself, when I saw that photo, I thought, I look like that sometimes.
Yes.
Like, pick it up. Yes. Or you'll go to your room.
Yes. She, I mean, she has to do a lot of that. I mean, we finally really do have an adult in the room.
Yeah.
With her. I mean, there was a lot of zeroing in on that photo, which, as you say, Trump used as an advertisement for himself and against Pelosi. But there were some generals, very big looking old men in the room looking down like scolded schoolboys, you know, and that was also, I thought, a powerful effect in the photo.
Well, because there's so much turnover in the administration and that a lot of people sort of walk into their job and are handed
a shit show?
Or a shit show.
Yeah.
So you had Joseph McGuire, the acting director of National Intelligence, who on probably day one is handed this, insane whistleblower complaint that he has to manage. Then you've got Mark Esper, who becomes the defense secretary because Patrick Shanahan's nomination implodes in his face, and he now is handed.
Is that the big guy? That's the big guy who's decorated? I mean,
oh no,
so
and so
sad.
That's General Mark Milley, who's the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Now he's in his job not because of just sort of out of regular rotations.
Yeah.
But he's brand new on the job. And so he's also walked into this. And so you could see just all of them like, can I please be somewhere else? And
yeah,
this is what the job entails.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we're delaying on this a little bit, that I think the fact that guys like Milley, and I cannot believe I don't recognize one of the Joint Chiefs. I mean,
oh, he's just, brand new, so you're...
Right, I know, still, though, the fact that they're all in acting and floating positions. I mean, I was looking around for a familiar face, and I was like, that's Mattis. Oh, no, Mattis is long gone.
Oh, right, and then you have Robert O'Brien, who's the new National Security Advisor, who
does he
previously...
look a little like Mattis? Please say that.
I actually don't even remember what he looks like.
Well, they're also quite hard to tell apart, because they all really do look alike.
Yeah.
But also, the idea that some of these guys are having to think all the moral authority in the room is going to the Speaker of the House, who's a woman, like a senior citizen woman, that they probably are not used to. I think that's why I was so interested in Crystal changing his mind, is that it took all this for the Democrat in the room from Congress, who, you know, these guys would usually look down on, cabinet members, generals, to really contain all that moral authority. I mean, it seems like the pins have been pulled out of any Trumpite position, any position that this is not, I don't know, constitutes Logan Act violations, FARA violations. We all know that Giuliani is in league with a company called Fraud Guarantee. I mean, how much more, I think of a scale. It's like Nancy Pelosi has everything and all these guys have nothing. They're like holding, you know, a bag of, as you say, isn't that word you use, shit.
Yeah, I think for some of them, especially the ones who are still in the military, like Milley, who, you know, aren't political appointees, are, you know, probably just trying to get out of this with their reputations intact. And Milley's predecessor, the chairman, General Dunford, mm-hmm. I think did. But obviously, you know, it's nearly impossible to do so.
I mean, you think they can get out with their reputations intact if they fly under the radar? I mean, and we don't really learn their names. Maybe that's why they keep their heads down. They're like, you know, no pictures, because if I can hang in here for, you know, 6 months, then maybe I won't be associated with Trump, because none of these guys are acting especially heroically.
Well, with Esper, it's interesting because on two fronts, and what we're seeing now is two fronts, is this Ukraine story going hand in hand with the serious story.
Yeah.
And it's kind of fascinating to watch them happening at the same time, because Republicans on the one hand are defending Trump to the hilt mm-hmm. on Ukraine mm-hmm. and yet are horrified by what's going on in Syria.
Yeah. Why do you think?
That's a really good question. I think his foreign policy decision mm-hmm. is actually not an impeachable offense, because
yes.
it really is where the president has the most latitude to.
I think I saw Quinta say this, and do you agree, Quinta Jurassic?
Yeah. I probably do, because I agree with most of it.
Whatever she says. But that, as much as we may disagree with foreign policy decisions, even if they seem to be piped in by the Kremlin, that those aren't themselves impeachable offenses. I don't know what an impeachable defense is, I do think that's interesting. And that we're not talking about, I don't know if you saw, but Lynn Cheney said Trump allowed this invasion of Syria, the potential sparking of a kind of genocide of the Kurds, the potential sparking of the re-rise of ISIS, which we've seen a little evidence of already, because the Democrats moved to impeach.
I mean, I'm thinking out loud here, but I think also with the Syria decision, it doesn't flirt with being criminal, whereas the Ukraine stuff does.
Ah.
If not flirt, but is maybe. But then also it could be an opportunity for the Republicans to say, see, greenlight's not the right word, but we don't whitewash everything. We're actually criticizing him in this corner. And I before I came in here, I think Mitch McConnell said that he plans to hold a vote in the Senate today on the resolution to sort of condemn Trump and his Syria decision that's even harsher than what was passed in the House yesterday, which is really interesting that McConnell sort of, you know, the Republicans, I think also they're moving as a pack on Syria. They've decided, all right, we're going to go for him on this. I mean, they're also at risk of abandoning, I think that they already have abandoned most of the platform of the Republican Party.
Yes.
But I think if they allow this to go uncriticized, you know, it's about being tough on terrorism. It's about being tough against Russia. It's about, you know, staying with your allies, supporting the military. All that's wrapped up in this.
Yes.
And if they go, you know, it's fine, we're going to get his back on this, they really have just thrown up their hands and kind of given up on what the Republican Party is supposed to stand for.
I think that's a great point. And it gets, even though Giuliani is involved, it gets the focus off the real carnies around Trump that nobody really wants to dip into. And for a while, these, you know, the goons that Giuliani was involved with, their Fruman at least, isn't in the center. And Dmitry Firtash, the person that you and I have studiously avoided knowing exactly anyway, but he's definitely Giuliani's side, Trump's side. But by talking about Turkey, I will also say that I just went to, do you ever go to Intelligence Squared debates? They have these formal Oxford-style debates on subjects.
Yeah, they're great, right?
They're so good. But this one had a group of four. The most recent one was about Middle Eastern foreign policy. They talked about Turkey's role in NATO. And one of the figures on the far right, I assume he's, I think he's on the far right to far right, said that he didn't want to talk about Khashoggi. He only wanted to talk in Saudi Arabia. He only wanted to talk about the Kurds. The Kurds pull at the heartstrings, or at least they justify a hawkish foreign policy. I mean, we have to remember when Saddam Hussein used weapons of mass destruction, I'm doing air quotes, on his own people, those people were Kurds.
Right.
So if we're going to tee up hawkish foreign policy in the Middle East, it's often done to defeat terrorism like ISIS and B, to defend the Kurds. I mean, this is so central to Republican and thinking about the Middle East on the right that, you know, I hadn't really given a lot of thought to this. I'm happy to say everything Trump does is bad, but I had to look pretty deeply into what the military was doing there and what a conscientious withdrawal might look like if it were ever justified. And, you know, I think for now I've come around to the view that we needed to have those troops there.
Brings us back to the letter. Yesterday, sort of the letter was released, but also Trump did two separate press availabilities, a press conference. And Trump said, you know, Turkey, Kurds, Syrians, there's a lot of sand that they can play with over there, basically.
That's right.
Again, I'm paraphrasing
and
committing a crime, so I apologize.
Treason.
And then he said, you know, the Kurds aren't angels, throwing them under the bus again, although he already has literally. And then saying, you know, the PKK, which is this Kurdish separatist movement in Turkey, are basically as bad as ISIS. So all of these things that he's saying are, you know, flying in the face of what Republicans are saying on the Hill.
Yeah.
And at the same time, this presidential delegation traveled to Turkey. They're meeting with Erdogan this morning. The photo's already from that. But to deliver the exact opposite message, Pompeo and Pence went on this trip to basically plead with Erdogan to stop, to pull back, to not kill any more Kurds. And then Kelly Kraft, who is our U.S. ambassador to the U.N.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
who's very much like Sondland, who's just a big political donor who got this job that she's not qualified for. She delivered this message at the U.N. that, I mean, Trump just is undermining not only his party, but he's undermining his very own cabinet in one day. And it's just astonishing. And it was already the case, but it was just hammered home yesterday. I mean, if you were a foreign ally or if you were a hostile nation, I mean, the U.S. government, the Trump administration does not speak with one voice. Erdogan had said before Pence arrived, I don't want to meet with Pence. I only want to meet with the president. Mm. And he's got a point, because what other people are saying to him at the end of the day does not match what the president's saying. And so nobody knows what to make of us.
I mean, you're right to say that he's now crossed up his cabinet and his appointees. I mean, he's always quarreled with the Republicans in the Senate, from McCain to McConnell. Remember when McConnell and Trump seemed like they were at odds with each other? That's another long time ago thing. But to just completely openly, you know, say the opposite, do the opposite, and you know, in plain view of all these foreign leaders,
yeah,
who have us over a barrel in so many ways. And I mean, Pence and Pompeo, I saw a picture of them in Ankara today, you know, walking around. You know, they've just both got the rapture on their minds. Like, what are we doing? I mean, that's my main question for you. This Pax Americana, we had my friend Asla Bali on the show really early on after the election. She's Turkish American and she teaches at UCLA. And she just said, you know, our careers are now going to change now that the Pax Americana is over. That was the first thing she said after Trump's election. Is that a phrase you even use at Just Security? And is that, I mean, was that a pipe dream always, the post-war world order being stabilized by the U.S., by things like the troops that Trump just withdrew?
I think the, like, so-called American era the post-war, you know. It started taking hits. I'm no expert on this, but yeah. It started taking hits before Trump. Obviously, I think people pinpoint the decision to go into Iraq as, you know, a major self-inflicted wound that was going to be hard to recover from. And now Trump is exactly that. And it's why I think Trump is likened to Brexit. It's these insane self-inflicted wounds.
Yes.
You were the leader of the free world.
Yes.
You chose not to be.
Yes.
And I think everyone's looking to 2020. If Trump doesn't get reelected, there's a chance, I don't think, to restore what once was, but to, you know, maybe count, like, write it off as an anomaly.
Yeah.
But if he, you know, if he gets another 4 years, then...
Yeah, that's not a phrase we use in this studio. So that's a particular counterfactual that we just don't. We're intellectually lazy that way. We don't think about another term. It's not good for the system, the cortisol levels.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title the Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
You watched the debate Tuesday night. What did you think of Buttigieg's, Mayor Pete's invocation of the day after Trump is president? Whether that's in 2024, we don't talk about that, or when he resigns or is defeated or is indicted or whatever, that there will be this day after. And Buttigieg really made the point, we're going to have a lot of work to do. It's not like that's just a day to, like, send up balloons or launch a new revolution, as some of, in particular, Bernie Sanders to the left of Buttigieg is saying, that that's when we really need these repairs, this kind of remediation of all this damage. And I think for someone like Buttigieg, who is focused on foreign policy, that means in the region we've been talking about. We've got to realign with our allies and make it clear to our enemies that we're no longer their puppets.
I think that allies will continue to be skeptical of the reliability of the United States, even, you know, if Trump isn't reelected. Because after that president, who knows when Trump 2.0 shows up? And I think whether it's the climate accords, the Iran agreement, you know, how reliable is a U.S. commitment to a certain cause? And then also, what happens to the Republican Party?
Yeah.
I mean, if the Republican Party continues to embrace Trumpism, then, you know, I have no idea what happens to the Republican Party, but I think if both political parties in this country sort of embrace like basic standards like rule of law and alliance building and things like that, then maybe foreign countries will feel better about things. But if you have this one party that is willing to burn the house down on the world stage, then you're always at risk of having to do business with them.
I think that was my concern about Biden is where my concern about people, you know, Sanders talking, using the word revolution, and then is the opposite of that is my concern that Biden will come in and his first meeting will not be in Saudi Arabia or Paris or Canada. It will be to go re-greet his buddies in the Senate, like Mitch McConnell, you know, and just say, we've been at this a long time and, you know, good to be working with you again. And I don't think that can happen here either, that there have to be consequences. And I mean, strategic organizational consequences, not like anybody you know, needs to go to prison or get down on their knees and beg forgiveness, but just more, I think I'm thinking about Buttigieg as a, and he's not necessarily my candidate, but I just like the order of his thinking. You know, he's a McKinsey guy. And so he thinks strategy and organization can save things. And I'm enough of a technocrat to kind of cotton to that rhetoric.
I do think it also depends on how we get from point A to point B. I mean, we have no idea where this impeachment situation is going. I would be shocked if the Senate removed Trump. And yet events are unfolding on an hourly basis here. And again, this Syria decision is putting so much pressure on them. Mm-hmm. It also shows, I mean, not only was Trump's green light to Erdogan, which it was, despite all the denials from his administration, was a bad decision for the United States, a bad decision for U.S. partners, but also a terrible political decision for Trump.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment when you're facing an impeachment crisis, don't piss off your party with one of the worst foreign policy decisions. And he did. And it either shows that he's a horrible negotiator, which I think it does. I think he caved to Erdogan's pressure. I mean, also his fondness for strongmen. I mean, I don't really know why Trump made this decision to cave and withdraw U.S. troops.
Well, you don't think it's what Zhirinovsky said, that now we're going to get, speaking for Russia, now we're going to get Ukraine and Syria.
It certainly could be, because Trump and Russia is just still a giant open question. We have no idea. We have no idea why he acts the way he does.
Do you think just Occam's razor? Are you, or does it feel like going, you know, we don't want to sound like Louise Mensch, but when Nancy Pelosi is saying all roads with you lead to Russia, do you think that it's time to really say what Hillary Clinton said in 2016? You know, Trump is Putin's puppet, and that is whatever our domestic politics, that needs to be taken into account. I mean, the cabinet needs to acknowledge that that's what's happening here. The Senate needs to acknowledge, Republicans in Congress need to acknowledge it. And what would be our marching orders if that were the case?
I think Trump is Putin's puppet.
Yeah.
We just don't know why, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But everyone should be operating as if he is, because he acts like it. He only, I think, doesn't when enough pressure is put on him by either Congress or forces within his administration. But those forces are either weaker or they're not existent anymore. And I'm thinking even though, like, they didn't, you know, there are a million reasons to criticize them, but people like Mattis and John Kelly, I do think, were at least doing a better job than the current crew of not enabling him, keeping misinformation away from him.
Mm-hmm.
Not completely, but I mean, I think we're looking at what it looks like when Trump is unleashed.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And what I also wonder about, and this calls for speculation, as they say in the courtroom, but is if, okay, so Trump gets the Mueller report and then he turns to Ukraine. So the most alarmist reading of that is that the Mueller report, and particularly Barr's framing of it and spin of it and misrepresentation of it, gave the signal to Trump that he could keep criming, or at least, right? So it was like, you're going to get away with this astounding set of things that you did to obstruct justice, but also to enable, to accept help from the Russians, to cross lines we've never seen crossed before in tampering with an election. And you know, he decided that meant no obstruction, no collusion. It just once again, I get away with this. I'm above the law. And just what, days later, he's on the phone to Zelensky asking him to, in July, asking him to interfere with 2020. Just, I'm going to do this again.
That's totally true. The message that that has sent is there are no consequences to your behavior. You are above the law, as your lawyers are arguing. But I do think Ukraine activities go back further than the conclusion of the Mueller report in that I don't think, I think Trump was sort of full speed ahead regardless.
Yeah.
As I was reading Sondland's opening statement today, he talks about how in April 2019, Petroshenko, is that?
Yes.
How you say his name? He lost the election to Zelensky, and that's when Zelensky became the president. And Zelensky had run on a reform platform, and it occurred to me that maybe that was a really pivotal moment. Maybe Petroshenko was their guy.
Yeah.
And Zelensky's win sort of threw their plan up in the air, and all of a sudden they had somebody who was less vulnerable to corruption, because his whole platform was anti-corruption.
Yes. We had Molly McHugh on who knows about Ukrainian politics, and she was saying that actually Zelensky, for all he's a comedian and in some ways looks like a Trump-like carny, you know, with a TV career, he's actually like pushed through various reforms very quickly when he got there. And this prosecutor that Trump, of course, has completely inverted, the prosecutor was actually being quite tough on corruption, the corruption that they actually worry about in Ukraine. But Trump styled this prosecutor as weak on corruption because to him, Biden is the centerpiece of, well, Biden's just his bete noire.
Yeah.
So that I think is interesting, right, as you say, to keep in mind that Ukrainian politics obviously were in their own even more than usual state of disarray or change.
Right. And you can tell that this crew, even Sondland and Volker and Perry, who appear to have done things, you know, pushing some of these things that they shouldn't have been. If Sondland is to believe, sort of be believed at some level on face value in what he's saying, they met Zelensky and they were like, he seems good. Like, he supports general U.S. policy toward Ukraine, like rule of law, anti-corruption. And so we really think Trump and him should, like, get together. And it's Trump and Giuliani who are like, I don't know. He seems to be surrounded by bad people.
Yeah.
And Yovanovitch, too, I'm sure, was, you know, pushing a very straightforward, basic, traditional U.S. policy. And they were like, no, that's not what we're here for.
Yeah.
We want to do shady stuff. And so you get, so Volker and Sondland and Perry are kind of like, come on, like, let's get these two guys in the room. We like this guy, Zelensky.
Yeah.
And they're getting this pushback from Giuliani, who's essentially speaking for Trump, like holding him at bay and wanting him to make these promises to do Trump's requests, which are investigate Biden and get deep in the weeds on a 2016 conspiracy theory about that the Russian investigation was a hoax set up by Ukraine, and that's sort of the back and forth. And I didn't quite get that dynamic fully until I was reading this today.
That's definitely an interesting twist. And I should admit, I have to now study that statement because it came in just as, right before you got here. We learned also yesterday that McConnell is saying, buckle in to the Senate and be ready for impeachment. And now I can't remember where this is from, but there's been talk of it going quite quickly now that we may see the Senate called for, you know, we may see a trial in the Senate. We may see articles of impeachment filed even this, as early as this month, and that something will happen, that in November we may see that real trial and a vote in the Senate. What do you think? I mean, I don't know. Make some predictions for me. Help me.
Oh, my goodness. I also saw yesterday John Yoo, who's the former lawyer in the Bush administration who wrote the torture memos. He was on Fox News yesterday saying, you know, impeachment's not allowed to happen so close to an election.
Oh,
that's against the framers' vision, which sounds a lot like Merrick Garland. You know, you can't have you can't do anything if you're within 3 years of an election. You know?
Right.
So maybe McConnell's thinking is partly that. This has to happen sooner rather than later. Like, we can't let this be part of the election cycle.
Yeah.
I think, though, that the House, I mean, they're doing depositions every day, but every deposition is critical. I mean, enormous amounts of information, I feel like, are coming out with each one.
And yes.
I know with each one, they're getting new names. I mean, even in the Sondland opening statement, I was like, huh, that's a name. He's putting people in the room mm-hmm. for some of these moments that I haven't heard before. And
yes.
So obviously, that person now has to come in and testify.
Yes.
And Bill Taylor of the Don't Text Me, Call Me.
Yes.
Or I would like to text you.
Yes.
Fame. I believe he's scheduled for next week. And so that's really critical.
Yes.
So McConnell's kind of putting the pressure on the House when the House is still developing their case.
My guest today has been Kate Brannon. She's the editorial director of Just Security, also a senior fellow at the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council. Thanks so much for being in the studio with me, Kate.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. What'd you think? Join us on Twitter. And let's reflect on this mad, mad world together. I'm at page 88. The show is at Real Trumpcast. And hey, if you're still here, you're committed to Trumpcast. So why not go to slate.com/Trumpcast Plus and become a Slate Plus member if you're not already. There's no day like today. And then you'll miss none of the Trumpcast episodes, even the ones exclusive to Slate Plus members. Our show today was produced by Melissa Kaplan and engineered by Merritt Jacob. I'm Virginia Heffernan. Thanks for listening to Trumpcast.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.